Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. David French of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And while we have a good martini, it's only a backup for David today because his real good martini is that the Memphis Grizzlies won last night and narrowed their deficit in the series with San Antonio to 2-1. Am I right about that, David?
Yes, you are exactly right. And as Coach Fizz would say, how's that for data? that was the viral exclamation that he made when questioning the officiating in San Antonio. He ended this long screed that included the memorable phrase, "You ain't gonna rook us," or "You're not gonna rook us," and then ended the screed and said, "How's that for data?" and slammed his hands on the table, which then instantly entrepreneurs created "How's that for data" t-shirts, which are selling like hotcakes.
I saw that during the game last night. All right, let's go get on to our actual martinis now. And our good martini for conservatives comes from the pages of The Hill. President Trump has saved taxpayers more than $86 billion in regulatory costs during his first 3 months in the White House, according to a new study from a conservative group. The American Action Forum points to several Obama-era regulations that Trump has either rolled back on his own or with the help of Republican lawmakers using the Congressional Review Act. This includes the Education Department's School Accountability Standards, the Environmental Protection Agency's Waters of the United States rule, and the so-called blacklisting rule for government contractors. These are just a few examples mentioned in the report. Since taking office, Trump and Congress have repealed 13 rules with the Congressional Review Act. That allows lawmakers to overturn recent rules they disapprove of with a simple majority in Congress and send the action to the president for his signature. So, David, obviously, this is good news. $86 billion, sadly, is not that huge of a dent in our debt or our deficit, but we're definitely heading in the right direction. And when it comes to really burdensome rules like the Waters of the United States, this is not just a cost saving. It's a paperwork nightmare avoided, too.
Yeah, I mean, this is incredible news. It's a drop in the ocean, I mean, to be clear, when it comes to the actual regulatory burden. But for the first time in a long time, it's as if we're making real progress. If there's any part of the domestic agenda of Trump that has gotten me really excited, I don't know right now what's going to happen to Obamacare. We don't know right now what's going to happen on tax reform. There's been a big victory with Gorsuch, but unwinding and unrolling back the administrative state, or even just merely halting it in its tracks, would be a tremendous advancement for a presidency. And so to see that there's some actual cost savings emerging, I know this is just the very beginning. I know that there's a lot of work to be done, but still, actually seeing that beast being starved just a little bit is very good news indeed.
It's very exciting. And if they can actually get business owners some even more help with tax reform, it's really going to be nice to save them money, to save them headaches, and hopefully be able to hire down the road as well. On to our bad martini today, David, and I feel a little bit guilty about not using this one with Jim Garrity, given the fact that he's the author of Heavy Lifting.
Right.
Grow up, get married, get a job. I don't remember the exact subhead, but those are the main concepts in the book. And there's more ammunition as to why those concepts need to be promoted. This is from CNSNews.com, courtesy of new numbers from the U.S. Census Bureau. 4 decades ago, in the mid-1970s, young American adults in the 18 to 34 age bracket were far more likely to be married and living with a spouse than living in their parents' home. But that is no longer the case. There are now more young people living with their parents than in any other arrangement, says the Census Bureau study. What is more, says the study, almost 9 in 10 young people who were living in their parents' home a year ago are still living there today, making it the most stable living arrangement. They compare the data to 1975. I'm not exactly sure why they picked that year, but nonetheless, in 1975, 14.7 million in that age bracket lived in their parents' home. 6.1 lived in an other arrangement, including with siblings, grandparents, other relatives, or unrelated roommates. 3.1 million lived alone, and 0.7 million cohabitated with an unmarried partner. In 2016, according to the Census Bureau, only 19.9 million were married and lived with a spouse, while 22.9 million lived in their parents' homes. Also in 2016, 15.6 million lived in an other arrangement, 9.2 million cohabitated with an unmarried partner, and 5.9 million lived alone. So, David, when you look at these numbers for each state, New Jersey's at the top of the list. 46, almost 47% of people in that age bracket in New Jersey live with their parents. And you get all the way down to 50th place, and it's still about 14%. So how big of a problem is this?
It's a big problem, and it's also a product of, I think, a number of different trends. One of them, I think, and this is something that, Jim talks about in Heavy Lifting, is this concept of delayed adolescence, that we don't really make kids grow up quickly anymore. You know, in the 1970s, an 18-year-old, there were an awful lot of parents who said, okay, you're either in college or you're on your own when you're 18. And that's just not the cultural answer anymore. And also, you know, we have changed the terms under which people get married. It used to be people got married earlier in life and, you know, they would go to college. I'm old enough to remember when I went to college, we had a whole section of our college called married student housing. And that was for undergrad students who were married. And when my parents were at Auburn University, where I was born, my mom was a sophomore at Auburn University and married student housing. So people used to get married and kind of grow up together in college. And now the message is, well, you finish your education, you get established in your job, and then you look for a spouse. Well, when you put it in that order, what ends up happening is you go to college, you're still living with your parents. Now more people go to grad school. They're still not quite on their own. Then they're looking for a job, and without the extra income of living, of, you know, having a spouse, they don't feel as independent, don't feel the need to be independent. So all of these things add together, and then combined with the financial instability of more fractured families, where there's just less ability to kind of strike out on your own, less pure financial ability, all of these things come together to add up to greater dependency for a longer period of time on your family and on your parents. And it's a negative trend. I think it harms the dynamism of our economy, of our culture. And I really think, you know, parents should start thinking hard when they're talking to their kids about marriage. Why is it the case that you say, well, you've got to wait X number of years until you've finished your entire education, you've gotten established in a career, and only then do you really start to look for your spouse? I'm not quite sure that's the best advice. I think that's often advice that's calculated to lead people to be single and looking for a really, really long time.
David, looking at the statistics here, I can imagine an argument that would probably come mostly from the cultural left, and they say, well, if you look back at 1975, your point's probably right that people got married sooner, but you had only 1% cohabitating. That's now 12% of the equation. And hey, those people are committed too. So ultimately, it all adds up. What do you say to that?
Yeah. Well, that's so completely wrong. I mean, all the social science indicates that cohabiting relationships, even when children are involved in cohabiting relationships, are inherently more unstable than marriages. This is true. Very much true in the United States. There's recent research indicating even in the cultures in Europe, which were supposedly so enlightened that cohabiting and marriage are essentially the same thing. It's also true in some of these countries. No, it's just not true. They're more unstable relationships. And one of the things about that instability is that you often end up having kind of a revolving door where children move in with somebody. It creates an unstable environment, especially when kids are involved, and then begins to foster this continued family dissolution trend that we see in the United States, especially in working class families, which impairs financial independence and financial security, and along with it, a lot of emotional independence and emotional security. So this is a negative trend. I just don't see how it's advancing our nation's, as I said, our cultural dynamism, our economic dynamism, it's a lot more like stagnation.
Let's move on to the crazy martini now. And David, I don't think it's so crazy this is actually happening. I think we're just disappointed that it's happening at this point. I'm sure on all the National Review conference calls, you and your colleagues are constantly lamenting, when is Barack Obama going to come back into the public view? We miss him so, so much. This is from Politico. Former President Barack Obama will make his first public appearance Monday, hosting an event on civic engagement back on his old stomping grounds at the University of Chicago. The event, open to the public but with limited tickets, will bring together younger leaders and students, quote, for a conversation on community organizing and civic engagement, unquote. It won't be an explicitly political event. Obama represented the neighborhood the campus is in while in the Illinois State Senate and was a law professor there. He last stopped by the campus in 2016 using an event at the law school to make a push for his failed attempt to appoint Antonin Scalia's replacement to the Supreme Court. It's stated in the event language that this event is part of his post-presidency goal to encourage and support the next generation of leaders driven by strengthening communities around the country and the world. So, David, I know that's in English, but go ahead and translate that for us.
It's the inner community organizer is coming back out. I mean, the Huffington Post will be thrilled by this. Slate will be thrilled by this. The Obamas are looked to not just as political leaders in some quarters of this country, but as cultural leaders and as inspirations and as celebrities in their own, you know, as celebrities in their own right that are worth covering just because they're seen on a boat with somebody. So I think that the demand for their services is going to be very selective, very concentrated in urban progressive America, but still very substantial. I think there's going to be a continued clamoring for that sort of Obama presence and that sort of Obama magic in the progressive left, because he's sort of their last shining example of victory. And really what has stood out and people have understood now is that he had an Obama coalition that was unique to him in 2008 and 2012, and that there's a special Obama magic, and it was not a Democratic coalition and a Democratic magic like they thought existed that was going to guarantee them the White House. So I think there's just a lot of people who are kind of turning their wistful eyes to him, especially when contrasted with the losing Hillary Clinton campaign, especially when they remember with misty eyes the inspirations of 07 and 08 and the victory in 2012. I just don't think the Democrats are going to be able to quit Barack Obama. I don't think they want to quit Barack Obama. But I don't think that much of the rest of America is going to care. I mean, this is going to be sort of our cocoon society showing itself with rapturous coverage and progressive outlets and indifference in most others.
David, on the surface, this is an event to inspire young people to, you know, be leaders in their community and beyond. How long till you think he publicly starts diving into policy debates?
And not long at all. I'm maybe in record time for an ex-president. He's a guy who's always been reportedly in love with his own opinion, the sound of his own voice, his own insights. And I think that, you know, he believes and people around him believe that one of the reasons why the Democrats and why the Clinton camp failed is because they just didn't do what he did. And I don't think he'll be able to resist it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he'll stick to sort of, you know, not really all that partisan, hey, young people, get involved kind of stuff. But I doubt it. I think he's going to weigh in. And I think he'll do it subtly at first and then with increasing ferocity later on. But we'll see.
Well, certainly will. That comes Monday. David, have a fabulous weekend. And we'll actually talk to you next Friday as well.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks so much.
David French of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. Jim will be back on Monday. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Have a terrific weekend, everyone. And tune in Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.